Hi, and welcome to Night Clerk Radio, Haunted Music Reviews. I'm Burke, joined, as always, by Mr. Ross Payton.
Hello.
Hey, how's it going, Ross?
It's going great. I am very excited for tonight's episode.
Me too, because tonight we are branching out. Just 5 episodes in, we're already breaking with our well-established tradition. We are discussing a topic, and that topic is Plunderphonics. Ross, do you want to give a little intro to Plunderphonics?
Yeah, Plunderphonics is a theory. It was formally written up by a musical composer, John Oswald, in 1985 with his essay, Plunderphonics. Plunderphonics, or audio piracy, is a compositional prerogative. He presented this to the Wired Society Electroacoustic Conference in Toronto. It's sort of kind of the manifesto for this subgenre of music, which in a nutshell takes sampling and make sampling into a musical instrument or an entire family of musical instruments. And obviously the term comes from plunder, to steal, and phonics, sound. So it's about stealing sounds. How do you steal sound? Well, in copyright law, that's very easy to do.
That's really the big thing. Yeah.
The basic idea of it is that because we have audio recording technology now, we can record sounds, but we can also edit them. We can also alter them. We can make them change their pitch, change their tone, just do 1,001 different things to them and make them sound something totally alien, something totally different. Mm-hmm. Yet copyright law does not allow us to use them except without express permission of the copyright author, as defined, you know, by whatever record label holds that usually. John Oswald sort of recognized that as unfair, and is also being able to reuse music to just adapt music or to change music that we hear every day is sort of a crime against music. Like,
Yeah, he had the really interesting point that a sampler or even a record player or whatever, people think of it as just a thing to produce sound that's already recorded. But he sort of made this argument that it is an instrument in and of itself, because through creative efforts of the user, you can produce, like you said, different sounds than were what originally recorded. And then the idea is copyright law sort of ruins that aspect of what a sampler or a record player can do. Mm-hmm. Sort of changes the fundamentally limits what a musician can do with an instrument to create music.
Mm-hmm. Like if you take another comparison, like literature, like all culture is based on what comes before it. Like I said many times, it's a conversation. You take what you grew up around, what you were taught, and then you sort of like respond to it. You say this is bad, or this is like, let's change it this way. You know, where would Shakespeare be if he couldn't reference the Bible and Greek mythology and other authors and poets that came before him? If he was shackled by copyright law and like all of culture was owned by a few giant corporations and they were very restrictive in what you could or could not do with them, then our culture would be all the more poorer for it, because, you know, we wouldn't have Shakespeare's great work. With music, though, we have this incredible, you know, everything from pop music to all kinds of subgenres out there, but you can't freely reference them. And of course, there is a discussion to be made about like plagiarism and theft. Even in fiction, the rules are different. You can make allusions, you can make references to cliches and tropes and archetypes and stereotypes.
Yeah.
In music, you really can't, because if it sounds too similar, then you're like, oh, you need to get permission from the author. Even if you're trying to make a parody or a satire for it, which is covered in literary fair use, but not for music per se.
Yeah, exactly. And music is particularly interesting because there's both a written and a performed component to music. So the idea of repurposing other songs didn't start in the 80s with Oswald. It had been around forever in terms of like quoting each other. Early jazz, like Coltrane, one of his first big things was doing like a really weird version of A Few of My Favorite Things from Sound of Music, or people like recutting broadcasts. But what really came out of sort of the 80s is that the copyright landscape changed, in that it used to be you could only copyright written music, like a score. So you could not, without permission, reproduce a score. And then I want to say, I'm going to get the year wrong, but in like the 70s, the US updated its Copyright Act, I think probably at the pressure of record studios, to include recorded pieces.
Yeah, that's actually referenced in the essay itself, Oswald's essay, 1976.
Right.
Yeah.
That's sort of what he's really fighting back against, is that that really affected how people could interact with music.
I mean, again, you have this very restrictive copyright law getting stronger and stronger to like restrict what artists can and can't do with it. And then on the other hand, technology is getting better and better to create new possibilities for engineering and like new techniques, things that weren't possible. Like, you know, one related technique that came before plunderphonics is this music concrete, which is sort of a French term for the idea of editing sounds like tape and basically making interesting sounds with them by like splicing them together or reversing them and just cutting them apart. These were like the sounds that they would be sampling, be like hitting pots and pans and just like normal environmental sounds, things that they recorded themselves, but like making them entirely alien and different by just messing around with microphone recordings and tape players.
Yeah.
And so that's like one of the first steps to Plunderphonics.
Yeah. And the idea of how high effort, especially if you've used like a modern DAW to work with multi-track stuff, how high effort it was for like Oswald to do his album Plunderphonics, because he did it all on magnetic tape. So it was all cut together by hand. All this like repetition was like weirdly done by hand. If he wanted to slow stuff down, I think he just had to put his hand on the turning cartridge and just slow it down manually.
Yeah.
You know, versus now where I can just drop a clip into something like Reaper or whatever, or Ableton, and just sort of drag it. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting how far that's come, how much work this was. I think there's an essay where he was talking about making some of these songs, and he would have to cut together hours and hours of material, cut that down to like 15 minutes, and then hopefully find like a 3 or 4 minute song in there. It was just this long, arduous process of experimentation.
Yeah, I mean, thinking about it, like thinking about how it's made, like this idea of discovery, of like being like taking different samples and putting them together and changing them and mixing them and merging them. It's fascinating because it's like you're trying to make music with an instrument, but you literally don't know how many keys are on this instrument. You technically have an infinite number of keys if you're willing to dig deep enough and to experiment enough. So it's basically like you don't even know the shape of your tools yet, because you could keep working on just the tools themselves theoretically forever. Just from like a creative process point of view, it's like, what if you had to write, but like the number of letters and you could use was infinite? Oh, well, that's a little more challenging. So no matter what you say about Plunderphonics, like the best examples of it are incredibly creative. Like they're extremely innovative and novel and just ear candy. A lot of times they're just fun to listen to because of this.
Yeah. Yeah. Like one I found was an Oswald piece where he was commissioned to do something based on Igor Stravinsky or somebody else's like mixtape. And it's such a simple idea, but he basically just dug up every single, something like 25 versions of the same piece and just laid them on top of each other. And you basically naturally get, because it's all human performances.
Yeah.
Not really like quantitized in pitch or beat. So you get like this natural sort of like kind of microtone, like weird, slightly out of tune, because they're all slightly tuned differently.
Yeah.
And then you get like this weird swelling because everybody's sense of time is slightly different. You know, maybe it's supposed to be played at 70 BPM, but it's humans. So some played a little bit faster, some played a little bit slower. And you just get like this like washing effect of the music. And it took nothing other than to like just lay those on top of each other.
Actually, you know what? There's another one he did called Grayfolded, which is, you know, the Grateful Dead were famously very permissive of people recording their live concerts. And they had many concerts, and there are many recordings of them. So they commissioned him to make something out of this. And so he took the same song, Dark Star, and just like got dozens of different performances of it in different concerts and made it into one like 17 minute piece that is pretty chill. I listened to it. It's a pretty nice composition. I really like it. We should put a clip of that in there. So that's just, I mean, if you listen to the Grateful Dead, as far as you know, that's every Grateful Dead show.
Yeah. Could you tell
a
Plunderphonic Grateful Dead jam solo from an actual?
I mean, if all you're using is Grateful Dead. Now, if you mix that in there with a couple other things, I'm sure it would blend wonderfully.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's fun. But like, I feel like a lot of the best Plunderphonics are the things that skirt legality, because Plunderphonics, the best ones, their legal controversy tends to be lawsuits because they didn't clear all the samples.
Yeah.
That's Punishmore's severely than almost anything else, because then they get their records pulled. On the other hand, if you know how to search for them on the internet, it's easy to find a lot of these albums because they're freely available, because they're not making money off of it.
Yeah.
You can't really technically pirate it because it was never for sale.
No, like the Plunderphonics album was not for sale. It was just handed out to radio stations and then they told people to copy it as it was broadcast. It was entirely like a steal this album ethos.
Mm-hmm. I know you really like that. Of course, I also like that is that Plunderphonics is political in this sense, in that it mm-hmm. is like taking a stand against copyright law as it is, because I think it is being detrimental to our culture. Because when you see these few examples of these people who are like, yeah, I don't care what trouble I get into, I'm just going to do it anyway. Mm-hmm. Just these few examples that we have are just enormously fun to listen to. I guess fun is very commoner, but there's some that are more meditative. I mean, we'll get into that in a little bit, but they're all definitely very pleasurable to listen to.
Yeah.
I mean, if this was more permissible, if obviously we don't know what we're missing. Who knows how many artists would have been brilliant or geniuses for this, but they didn't want to take the trouble to do it.
Or it just gets pulled from like YouTube or SoundCloud before anybody finds it.
Yeah, you know? That's true. There was one artist I was trying to tell you about, and it took even a while for me to even find their Bandcamp or anything else because, mm-hmm. you know, they're pretty obscure. Monkey Farm Frankenstein, which took horror movie samples with hip hop. And there was about a 6-month period where I listened to Twitch at the Deaf Nerve basically every day. It's definitely one of those albums I got burned out on, but it's still like re-listening to it, it's like, yeah, this is good.
So it's sort of interesting that we're talking about Plunderphonics now in the context of like a vaporwave podcast. But sort of in some sense, almost maybe unbeknownst to us, we had actually listened to a lot of Plunderphonics music for the last couple decades.
Mm-hmm.
Especially me, without really knowing that that's what it was. Like, I knew what Plunderphonics were, but I didn't know that some of the artists I really enjoyed in like the 90s and 2000s mm-hmm. fell in that regime. So that makes it a very natural connection to vaporwave. So some artists are like DJ Shadow, who we can talk about for a little bit.
Yeah, DJ Shadow. And also just for me, the first time I saw the word Plunderphonics mm-hmm. was on Bandcamp because I was looking up vaporwave artists. And it's like vaporwave, Plunderphonics. And then I'm like, what the hell is Plunderphonics? I click on the tag, I look around, and then I Googled around. I'm like, okay, this is all right. I'm into this. And then eventually I found out, oh, DJ Shadow is considered a Plunderphonics artist, and it's like, oh yeah, because his most famous album Introducing is like entirely sampled. Mm-hmm. And there's sort of a discussion to be like, what is the difference between Plunderphonics versus, I guess, just pure turntablism versus trip hop versus just doing mashups and remixes, because this is not just sampling. I mean tons of artists use samples, obviously.
Sure.
This is not like Vanilla Ice taking the beat from Under Pressure.
No, it wasn't. It was slightly different. It was bum, 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 bum,
bum, bum. Yeah. Sorry. My bad.
You're going to get us in trouble with the law, Ross.
Yeah, clearly. Yeah, Vanilla Ice is going to drive up from Florida.
He's not doing anything.
Yeah, he is. He's flipping houses. He's got a reality show flipping houses.
Are you serious? All right.
Yes.
That's going to make me mad. Let's just get back to the music.
Yep. We live in a hell world. Sorry.
We do.
Sorry. Yeah. I saw it on the plane.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it was.
But you do raise a good point about sampling versus like true Plunderphonics. And I wonder if kind of the original ethos of Plunderphonics, like what at least Oswald was trying to do, was take a single song and sort of cut it together. And the idea that he sort of defined Plunderphonics was it has to be sufficiently mutated that it's an original piece of art. It's like mm-hmm. your creation, but not so mangled that you don't know where it comes from.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if that was actually what he thought of as Plunderphonics, or if he would enjoy stuff like DJ Shadow and Girl Talk, because he couldn't do that sort of rich mashup sampling with the technology yeah. he had in the 70s and 80s.
I mean, DJ, like, Introducing was like 96, 97. Mm-hmm. So I feel like the technology didn't go so far beyond 1985 that like Oswald would have been unable to do that. I think part of it is also Death of the Author. Like, it's not like John Oswald is the final authority of Plunderphonics.
No, I don't mean to claim he is. I always thought about that. The 90s, there was a pretty big boom in samplers.
Sampling became a lot more prevalent in music, pop music, and obviously hip hop.
Sure.
DJ Shadow went to an entirely different level.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like Introducing, so, you know, influential and so defining for a lot of people that, you know, obviously it's Plunderphonics, it's also trip hop, which of course then leads into in my theory, leads into Toonami music, which leads into lo-fi hip hop. So we're still dealing with that legacy.
Endless subgenres.
Endless subgenres. I mean, that's the thing, is I don't know where the line is myself. I feel like if it's more that maybe it's 50% plus one, you know, more sampled than original, then it counts as Plunderphonics.
You have like a Plunderphonics council that sets the rules for you.
Yep. Yeah. No, clearly needs strict regulations.
That's really in the spirit of the genre.
A lot of it, I think it is like being able to recognize some samples. Well, there's two sides of it. Like, I think for some of it, like, oh, I recognize that. And then like hearing it in a new context is like, ooh, that's cool. But the other side of it, and I feel is key to it, is also the educational side to it. I feel like every person who makes Plunderphonics music is driven by a deep urge to create and to educate, mm-hmm. because they love music so much. They want to share it with people. They want to dig up this obscure stuff that they found, these hidden gems, and like show them to new generations. And DJ Shadow is obviously the king of that in a lot of ways, because he took a lot of obscure music. Like, one of the things, there's a documentary I watched years ago about turntablism. Mm-hmm. In this documentary, there's a quote that like haunts me, because I also apply it to my own life too. The quote is, just being in here, and in here, he's talking about a record store that he spent years digging up records. And then they had this basement with tens of thousands of records. And it's a record store you can see in the music video for Midnight in a Perfect World. So like, Midnight in a Perfect World is essentially, it's about his love of music. His perfect world is being in this basement, looking up, going through thousands of vinyl records. Mm. So just being in here is a humbling experience for me, because you're looking through all these records and it's sort of like a big pile of broken dreams. Whether you wanted to admit it or not, 10 years down the line, you'll be in here. So keep that in mind when you start thinking like, I'm invincible, I'm the world's best or whatever, because that's what all these cats thought. I mean, for me, I can tie it back to my own childhood, because I would go through these flea markets and antique stores. Mm-hmm. My parents were antique dealers at one point, and so I had no idea what all this, but I could see, just this stuff is old. There's like a whole universe out there that I have no idea what's going on. The scale of human effort and invention and creation and destruction, as all these things have been discarded, was mind-boggling to me. Occasionally, I would find really interesting things as I was, you know, forced to wander through all these dusty flea markets, like, oh, here's some comic books that are like 10 for a dollar. Oh, great. I can read about robot soldiers fighting in World War II. This is neat. And that kind of thing.
Your past present was haunted by a past itself.
Yeah, exactly. So like, in Midnight in a Perfect World, we can have this clip of this song that DJ Shadow samples from Pekka Pohjola. The song is, the translation is Madness Subsides, and it's a 1974 record. And then that becomes sort of the opening for, and the foundation for, Midnight in a Perfect World. So here's the original. And here's the beginning of Midnight in a Perfect World.
Insight, foresight, more sight. The clock on the wall reads a quarter past midnight.
Think about it and understand it.
The thing for me is that when you go to Pekka Pohjola's YouTube video for this song, that we use, that it's like the top comment there is someone saying, you know damn well who brought me here. So it's like, it's educational. These people, you know, hundreds of people dug up this obscure album, and maybe some of them converted over and started becoming fans of this Finnish musician because of this one hook in this one song. And I find that just sort of like, I don't know, deeply satisfying on a spiritual level. That
Yeah, that's really interesting. For me, DJ Shadow is interesting just because it was always, I didn't realize how popular that first album was. Like, it was everywhere in high school. I just didn't realize it until I re-listened to it for this episode. Just so many of those songs were like just themes for Newground flash videos and stuff. So it's like very appropriate in some way. Mm-hmm. I think I have a much stronger connection to sort of another artist we were discussing, Girl Talk. Girl Talk is a DJ from Pittsburgh who does unbelievably intricate mashups that just piece together, like literally just, I'm going to take just one part of one drum beat from this song and one part of one drum beat from another song, put them together, layer over all kinds of like pop and hip hop and classic rock, and just creates these really fun experiences. It's great because all the albums that Girl Talk puts out are free. They're just put up online.
Yeah.
You can just go grab them. I actually really like, I had a version of All Day, which was kind of their 2010 album. That was like my gym jam in 2010.
Oh, yeah.
No. That opening of War Pigs. Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It was just, I didn't have tracks. The download was just functionally one hour track.
Yeah.
And it just flows effortlessly. Like you would never be like, oh, somebody just didn't cut this up into different tracks because there's a clear break.
Yeah.
It was interesting. It's like, I think the idea of you saying it was fun and sharing it is really, really apt there, because it was literally just like an hour tour through someone's favorite music from the last few months and how it relates to older music.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing with the Girl Talk, is he has a love of a lot of pop music. It merges a lot of different genres together in really interesting ways. Mm-hmm. Country and rock and hip hop and punk, and like it just, yeah, it'll get you up and moving too.
Yeah, and I really like it because, you know, I sort of overlap in that I like a wide range of that stuff. Mm-hmm. So there's also like a fun thing of trying to figure out what all the samples are.
Yeah.
Because they're so buried and they're so removed from context. Like they're so well taken out of what they were originally intended for and repurposed into something new that you're just like, oh, there's like two measures of some drum beat. What is, oh, it's, you know, Fleetwood Mac or whatever. And it's, mm-hmm. it's deceptively engaging for just like a bunch of party mashups to be needlessly reductive.
Actually, looking at his Wikipedia right now, he says some of his musical inspirations are Square Pusher and Aphex Twin. It's like, ooh, boy.
Okay.
He's just, yeah, hitting on all the things, isn't he? Also, those are two artists I listened to a bunch back. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And noise music artist Merzbow. Wow.
I always got to throw one in there.
Mm-hmm. Girl Talk is a lot of fun. Night Ripper and All Day are amazing works. I actually need to catch up and see what he's done lately, because I have not.
I think, unfortunately, he kind of stopped doing the big mashup album.
Yeah, he was hit with a bunch of different, like...
Yeah, I think it got too popular.
That's unfortunate. You know, one thing I do like, the idea of the mix, like seamlessly blending it from one track to the other, like you were saying, because it creates these interesting segues and transitions. Yeah, the structure of it is really, it's really good pacing, I think. Mm-hmm. The thing I really like, really frenetic openings to sort of calming down to building up. It's, you know, managing a party, whether it's an actual party or, you know, just in your head. It's sort of understanding the rhythms of what motivates people
yeah.
to move around.
It's like a constant barrage of earworms. Mm-hmm. It's like being stuck in somebody's head when they have 40 songs stuck in their head.
You're really gorging yourself like on a novel mix of the best hooks, beats, and riffs from pop music of the last like 30 or 40 years. It's just like, yeah, earworm after earworm. You're just like, just hit me with the good shit. You know? Like, he's just getting out of all the filler. He's just like, yeah, that's a good beat. That's a good hook. Like, we're just put it all together.
I just listen to everything at once.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, let's get through all of music in an hour.
Yeah. We can just, yeah. Of course, another artist I really like, sort of a similar shot, and I don't know if there would be a Girl Talk if this artist hadn't come through, would be the Avalanches, who are also very fun, a sense of joy. They actually came out with their second album like a few years ago. Their first album was sort of like a masterpiece of Plunderphonics, Since I Left You, which came out in 2000. So it's a couple of years after introducing. Their second album, Wildfire, came out in 2016. Avalanches, Since I Left You, is entirely sampled. Like there's nothing that they didn't get from somewhere else. Mm-hmm. But the sheer number of samples that they used, no one knows. Like, they've lost count themselves. They're like literally thousands of samples. Let's see, they estimated that Since I Left You was a sample from approximately 3,500 vinyl samples.
Wow.
Yeah, there's YouTube. We'll put a link in the show notes for like a analysis of one that gets some of the more noticeable, more easily traceable samples. The opening song, you know, Since I Left You, and then of course Frontier Psychiatrist, which has this amazing music video. They're just fun, and it's the sound is like, I couldn't really characterize it as anything other than Plunderphonics because it's so dancing all over the place. It's just like jumping from genre to genre a little bit. It's getting a little bit of this and that, and it's not really, you couldn't really put it anything else other than like, I don't know. These are really Plunderphonic's albums. You couldn't really characterize them as anything else.
No. And I had not heard of Avalanches until sort of they came up. We were putting thoughts together for this episode. Mm-hmm. I only recently listened to Since I Left You. And yeah, it's great. It's fun. I think it's a good middle ground in a lot of ways because it is like Girl Talk. We have this really fun sort of frenetic bombardment of all these different samples. Mm-hmm. But they still, I think, not that Girl Talk doesn't put a lot of effort into what they do, but the effort they invest is sort of mutating things, like mixing around time signatures or like changing things to be completely different songs instead of like a continually layering of songs, which I really enjoyed. I think there's a nice blend between sort of those two ideas.
Yeah, I mean, different artists have different like aesthetics, even within Plunderphonics. Like there's a very unique style to the Avalanches that you don't have. Like Girl Talk is definitely like for the dance club. And like the Avalanches are not really that. Like this is a fun album, but it is, I don't know, like, yeah, if they have a particular place to listen. Like DJ Shadow is like driving through the city at night, wondering about your life. You know, like it is at the all night coffee shop or dealing with an existential crisis and you're surviving. But man, life is weird in the city. The Avalanches, I don't know, like it's also a very Australian thing, too, I feel like.
Sure.
Because they're an Australian group. Mm-hmm. There's a bit of, yeah, nah, we'll get it done. Yeah. I'm working on my Australian dialect, you know, accent. How am I doing?
No, you're doing great as an Australian. I would work hard to build an American accent. I think your Australian accent's great.
Thank you. Thank you, Burke.
You'd blend right in Melbourne.
Yep, not a problem. Frontier psychiatrists in particular. It's also really defined by the idyllic past, like the 1950s. They have a lot of these samples from vocal records that have that old-timey sound to it that give it sort of this sort of really, it's a very hauntological album because it's very much haunted by the past of music and pop culture as it talks of every, you know, sampling educational films and, you know, pulp movies and... Yeah, where would you listen to that? That's an interesting question. I hadn't really thought about that. But
yeah,
I quite enjoy it. I've listened to it many, many times. I mean, there are other artists too. These are by no means the only Plunderphonics ones. There's Danger Mouse, who did the Grey album, which is Jay-Z plus the Beatles. Mm-hmm. It's a very interesting album. In fact, some of the Beatles actually spoke out saying they like the album.
Yeah.
But obviously, you can't be legally released. So you just have to download it or find it on YouTube or wherever.
Beatles can love it all they want. If EMI doesn't want it out there, doesn't matter.
Yeah, exactly. There's Negative Land.
Yeah.
Which is more contemporary to John Oswald, like more of an 80s thing. Mm-hmm. Like they got in trouble for doing U2, which was a song that incorporated, again, the sense of anarchism in Plunderphonics, which is they take this rant of Casey Kasem, the radio DJ, being angry about them choosing a U2 song and just him being pissed off at U2 in general.
Yeah, just being an old man, just being a grumpy old man.
Yeah, exactly. So that's a fun thing.
Yeah, so here's a Casey Kasem, really mad at U2, set to some music.
That's the letter U and the numeral 2. The four-man band features Adam Clayton on bass, Larry Mullen on drums, Dave Evans, nicknamed The Edge, on... This is bullshit. Nobody cares. These guys are from England, and who gives a shit?
Oh, my God.
Just a lot of wasted names that don't mean diddly shit.
For sure, you don't know where you're at. There's so much shit about you.
This is bullshit.
Sounds like it's portable, yeah.
Who gives a shit?
This track is, you know, it's one track. It has an interesting legal history, but it also points out, I think, an important thing that Plunderphonics doesn't have to also be about stealing music. Mm-hmm. Like there's a whole culture of stealing like radio recordings, field recordings, and working that into what you do as well. It's a very fluid idea.
Yeah. Again, it's being able to reference the stuff that you already hear around you. And that's why copyright law is so stifling, because we can't have these conversations that we just naturally have. And music is no different than anything else. Like you hear this type of music that's very popular. Why wouldn't you want to riff on it or to reference it or to sample it, to do something new and cool with it? That, again, it's just, you know, kind of limiting us.
Especially in an era where something like YouTube is one of the major ways, probably YouTube and Spotify are probably the two major ways people consume new music.
Yeah.
And YouTube has one of the most unfair and aggressive copyright algorithms probably ever implemented. It's so biased in favor of the person making the claim that you basically cannot fight it without significant resources. Even a fair use claim can put your channel in jeopardy if YouTube just comes back and says, nah.
Yeah, no, that's true. I do know, for example, that Lindsay Ellis, prominent YouTuber, is actually suing YouTube right now because, you know, their automated appeal system is basically atrocious. And she had a video monetized against her desires because she made a fair use sample of something, which violated her sponsorship deal with Audible, which she had no control over. So, yeah, it's...
Yeah, and another thing like that I see it come up a lot in is I watch a lot of music education YouTube channels. So like Rick Beato and Adam Neely and Signals and all these others. And they constantly complain that, you know, if you were to, you know, say a formal education environment, learn about music, you would listen to music. But they can't play music for you, even though it clearly falls under educational fair use because their channels would get destroyed.
Yeah.
You know, they have to find new ways to kind of teach you about music, and it's really hard.
Yeah, no. Yeah, I didn't even consider that, but that is... Yeah, imagine trying to learn literature without being able to read, you know, the actual things that they're talking about. Yeah, it'll be interesting. Like, we are going to be uploading episodes to YouTube, so it'll be interesting to see if this episode has any problems with the YouTube algorithm.
Yeah, we literally had a 15-minute conversation about, like, what's probably the safest things that we can play for you.
Yeah.
I would love to let you listen to some girl talk, but I just can't because it's...
Yeah, we don't want to get demonetized.
You know? It'll immediately get flagged.
Yeah. You know, I mean, there are some artists who do plunderphonics that do more overt things that, like, not even referencing music. I'm like, there's the Emergency Broadcast Network who did clips of news anchors and making them say funny things by just, you know, sampling and referencing them.
So I think, you know, we've been talking sort of a lot about plunderphonics, but this is a vaporwave kind of quotes podcast. So I think the connection to vaporwave is fairly obvious. Vaporwave is probably fair to consider a subgenre of plunderphonics.
Yeah, a lot of people do make that connection. I mean, it like plunderphonics laid the sort of theoretical groundwork to like make the claim that vaporwave is a legit, you know, music genre, which it is. But like, here's the reason why that taking Diana Ross and pitch shifting her and slowing it down and everything is like, oh no, that's still music because it's...
Yeah, so I would say in production methods of working from samples, it definitely satisfies. I think it also shares a lot of the ethos, sort of pushing back against music as a commercial product. So much vaporwave is not released for profit. It's just put up on Bandcamp or YouTube or whatever for people to find. You know, they're not trying to sell it. They don't care if you download it. I mean, they do sell cassettes and vinyl pressings of bigger albums. Like 2014 had a big vinyl, you know, Floral Shop vinyl.
There have been like one or two for Floral Shop, but although there have been a lot of unauthorized ones.
Yeah, there have been a lot of really bad illegal pressings too, you know, and it's interesting. I think also sort of plunderphonics in the vaporwave context of not just an audio, but a visual medium, there's a pretty clear way that you can adapt the concepts of plunderphonics to visuals. That's not a novel concept. People have done that before. I think there was a movie called The Strain Andromeda that was just the Andromeda strain, but in reverse, but with the dialogue forward.
I like that.
Yeah, like in the 90s.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's some precedent for visual, and I think that's definitely starting to come out.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would argue that YouTube is probably visual plunderphonics, like YouTube meme culture of taking things
definitely
and recutting them into new videos absolutely satisfies that. But, you know, YouTube also drives a lot of music plunderphonics innovation. You know, there's all kinds of periods of trendy music editing. So there's like the whole phase of taking pop songs and like swapping beats two and four or like taking parts of measures out to create new songs. Probably, man,
mashups.
Yeah, mashups. Neil Cicierga has several very popular albums. They're just meme remixes of Smash Mouth over and over and over again, mashed into other songs. So it's definitely alive and well kind of in the modern internet music culture that we really sort of initially focused this podcast.
Yeah, no, I mean, like back when Plunderphonic, this essay came out and like Oswald, you know, had his battle with the record industries because of his album and everything, like, you know, the record labels thought that, you know, they won because they won the lawsuit and they control the laws and they have the lobbies. But, you know, plunderphonics clearly won the culture war.
Oh, yeah.
As technology improves, we're digitizing everything that can possibly be digitized. Every book, every movie, every TV show, everything's becoming available digitally, not just on YouTube, but on archive.org, on various pirate networks. You know, like there's so many ways to get like, oh man, I love this TV show from the 80s that went for two episodes. You just search for it. There's going to be some like Daily Motion or some French or Russian site that's going to have it.
Yep.
It's going to be a low res rip, but somebody went to the effort to do that.
Or you'll find everything everything is terrible, recutting it into their own.
Exactly. Everything's terrible. And that's the thing, is like people are taking this stuff and reusing it. So like kids who had no idea what any of the stuff will see like a Russian folk singer going trololo from, you know, and just like having a ball with it.
Yeah.
And or like some guy blinking weirdly in some 1980s show, like that becomes a meme in himself.
Yep.
So everything is becoming, you know, Borges' Library of the Infinite, basically, where all everything is becoming invincible.
I would even argue that there's been a Plunderphonics inspired TV show on like a fairly major network.
Oh yeah.
Which is, I was thinking about this because I was thinking about the visual side of this. I think C-Lab 2021, at least the first season, is Plunderphonics.
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah. No, that's very much a Plunderphonics show because they're reusing the artwork.
C-Lab 2021, if anyone doesn't know, was one of the many sort of 11-minute little weird short TV shows that was on Adult Swim in the early 2000s. And the two guys who created it were basically PAs at Cartoon Network. And they just took all this footage of this old show, C-Lab 2020, and they just recut it into new episodes, put some new voices on it, and just called it C-Lab 2021. It's total repurposing of the old into the new. It's absolutely Plunderphonic.
Oh, yeah. No, that's actually a good point.
But that's Plunderphonics that made money for a major corporation. That's always the thing, is that a lot of these copyright lawsuits are sort of under the fallacious argument that the reuse of their material is a net loss to profit.
Mm-hmm.
But whether or not someone uses a 15-second clip of some song doesn't hurt. Like, that doesn't hurt your album sales.
Mm-hmm.
And people have done studies like this. I think with Girl Talking All Day, they did a little study that just making people listen to that, they would hear things they like and go seek them out. So it functionally raised awareness for these tracks.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, people are no one would remember C-Lab 2020 if it wasn't for 2021.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Or like a modern, you know, people who are maybe in college in like the 2010s, not to be like an old man, but there's no reason that they would know who like Journey or like any of these classic rock albums are,
mm-hmm.
unless they're exposed to it in some sense. And that's an exposure to it that they normally wouldn't get.
Also tying Plunderphonics back into Vaporwave.
Mm-hmm.
So in issue one of The Virtual House, a new sort of zine that's coming out, they did an issue on Vaporwave, and they had an interview with the guy who runs DMT Tapes FL, which is a record label for Vaporwave, and they put out cassette tapes of like Waterfront and Dining is sort of their biggest name on DMT.
Okay.
In the interview, he says, "What is at the heart of very heart for Vaporwave for you? The appeal to me is the limitless potential that old songs hold and the relevance that old sounds can bring to making entirely new music. I sometimes refer to Vaporwave as playlist the genre, or mixtape the album. The idea is like many Vaporwaves are essentially that playlist of old songs that have been manipulated and treated to these same parameters of a common mix. The result is a genre and release format presentation unlike anything I've experienced in the years of being music obsessed." So like, I mean, and again, that sort of obviously heavily bleeds into Plunderphonics, like Girl Talk. It's a mixtape. It is a hell of a mixtape. I mean, it's more than just a mixtape, but that's kind of the starting point. Yeah, this idea is that sort of, again, the transition. We go from Plunderphonics to Vaporwave because of this, changing what we do and what we don't do with it.
Absolutely.
I would also say, again, we're technically a haunted music review podcast, but I would say Plunderphonics definitely qualifies because these are...
Oh, yeah.
Plunderphonics comes from musicians haunted by music.
Mm.
Like, they are obsessed with music. They want to share it and to change it with music that's already been made. This jazz drummer, George Marsh, who was sampled in DJ Shadow's Building Steam with a Grain of Salt from the album Introducing, the music comes through me, and I would like to let what is inside of me, which is what comes from all the music that I hear, I would like for that to come out. And it's like, it's not really me that's coming. The music's coming through me. And so they're possessed by the spirit of music. And like, they just have to make more music.
I like it.
Yeah. That's why DJ Shadow sampled that particular quote from that interview from a 1974 vinyl record of interviews with jazz musicians, which he obviously found in that basement because it was super obscure.
Mm-hmm.
Now you can listen to that whole interview on YouTube because, again, someone digitized it because it's Borges' Library. It's all coming together. So yeah, Plunderphonics is sort of, you know, the whole creative urge, unrestrained by law or common sense. It's just, what can the technology do when I have all of the available music and all the best technology to do whatever. My only limit is my imagination, which is terrifying, but we get stuff like the Avalanches and DJ Shadow and Girl Talk
and Vaporwave.
And Vaporwave.
So thanks for listening to our brief little, well, supposedly brief discussion of Plunderphonics. I think it's been really interesting to kind of explore how a genre I didn't think much about has actually influenced most of my music listening habits for probably 20 years. So it's always a good journey of self-education on this podcast. We're going to dig into some seriously haunted music with Dungeon Synth, which is a very, very niche subgenre of dark ambient, kind of from the 80s and 90s, almost like video game music meets metal.
Yeah, it's very much sort of stylized. A lot of that I've seen is stylized to sound like Amiga and, you know, old Mac computer RPGs, like Pool of Radiance, kind of like,
yeah,
you are an old wizardry games. It's real interesting.
Yeah, it's black metal in MIDI form.
Yeah, there you go. That's exactly it.
Nailed it.
So yeah, we'll have some great Dungeon Synth to listen to.
That's right. So if you want to keep up with that and everything else we're doing, you can follow us on Twitter at Nightclerk Radio. Ross is at Ross Payton. I am at Burke McBurkinson. Check the show notes. Thanks again. Please take the time to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or your podcast app of choice. Leave comments, both because it really helps us sort of know what you'd like, but also because it's how we game the system until we can collapse it. Thank you. Stay haunted. Thank you.